And so the second part that makes me uncomfortable or really weary of the way we're using trauma is that it's become a label that means you are no longer responsible for the way you show up in the world. And that's a hard thing to say. Like, I want to tread carefully. I know this is not
Totally.
a popular opinion. And I think if you're experiencing something like PTSD, your freedom is limited in how you show up in the world. However, for a majority of people who have lived through traumatic events or and are not traumatized, or individuals who don't actually have trauma, it's just become a convenient way to say, well, it's not my fault.
If you're a high achiever who wants your ambition to extend beyond your professional goals and into your well-being and relationships, you're in the right place. I'm Valerie Martin, a certified high-performance coach and therapist of 12 years, and I'm obsessed with teaching and coaching folks how to cultivate compassionate self-discipline. We all have a spark alive within us, no matter how small or dim it might feel right now. And it is our greatest purpose and our greatest responsibility to honor it. Because when we do, we become better partners, leaders, parents, creators, and family members in the interconnected web of this wild, dark, miraculous, beautiful world. Tune in every other week for a new interview or solo episode and connect with me on Instagram at Honor Your Spark. Let's jump into the episode. Hey, y'all, welcome back to Honor Your Spark. I'm so excited you're here and you are in for a real treat with today's conversation. So, before I tell you about our guest, let me share what I've been watching, reading, and loving lately. And by the way, if you like these recs, you definitely want to make sure to sign up for my Spark letter. You can do that at honoryourspark.com/email. So, recently I watched the movie Mud, starring Matthew McConaughey. And it was so good. This came out in 2012, but I was just kind of scrolling through his catalog looking for some of the movies of his that I hadn't seen because I just really love him as a human, loved his memoir, and was just in the mood for that kind of vibe. And we watched this movie, and it was very much like a Mark Twain, Huck Finn kind of vibe, coming of age. Really, really excellent story. Heavy, but really feel good at the same time, which is hard to pull off, I feel. Written and directed by Jeff Nichols. So, highly recommend Mud. I can't remember where it was streaming, but it's on one of the big platforms. Reading, and I just started this book last night, but I'm super excited about it, especially from all the reviews that I've read. It is a series, and this is the first book in the series by Jodie Taylor, a British author, called Just One Damned Thing After Another. And it comes from this great quote at the beginning, which says, "History is just one damned thing after another." Gotta share that with my stepdad, who's a historian. I think he'd like that. I pulled this little snippet from one of the Kindle or Amazon reviews. It said this is one of the most bizarre, riotous, insane, genre-defying, unique, comedic, tragic, bloody, sexy books out there. I'm like, sign me up. There's time travel, there's historical fiction. Let's go. So I'm excited about that, especially because there is a spin-off series that is about the Time Police, which I don't yet know about, but I know there's time travel involved. So I love the topic of time. So very excited about these two series. And then I am loving, and I forgot to bring it into the shot, it's sitting on my table back there, my Panda Planner. This is one I've been sort of eyeing for years. And if any of you out there can relate to, like, you're always searching for the perfect planning system, the perfect planner, yada, yada. I have played with so many things. I'm still loving TickTick, which is my sort of digital task management planning, but I realize I still want something on paper, and my very basic planner just with the week view wasn't cutting it. So I'm excited to give this one a shot. It's got all of the boxes and things that I love. So I'm really hopeful that I'm going to actually like it and find it really valuable. I got the 3-month version, so can give it a try. Okay, let me tell you about our incredible guest today. She wrote a book called It's On Me, and this is like definitely in my top 10 recommendations for any of my therapy or coaching clients. It's a phenomenal book. I told her that she really got me inspired to follow my curiosity about existential therapy and go deeper in that. So I mentioned in the last episode, I'm reading Yalom's book on that topic. So yeah, this conversation and finding this guest, this author, maybe will change the trajectory of what my future therapy career looks like. So that's really exciting. Her name is Dr. Sarah Kubrick. She's an existential psychotherapist, consultant, writer, and columnist for USA Today. She's often known as the Millennial Therapist due to her Instagram handle at millennial.therapist and large online presence. She was born in Yugoslavia and raised in Canada. Sarah is passionate about helping people change. Her interest in psychology stems from her personal experience living through wars, navigating complex relationships, and continually learning what it means to be human. You can find her at Sarah, S-A-R-A dash Kubrick, K-U-B-U-R-I-C.com. That will be in the show notes. And on Instagram, like I mentioned, at millennial.therapist. She also has a Substack blog that you can subscribe to. That's all linked at her website as well. So I'm super excited for you guys to hear this conversation. We got into all kinds of juicy topics. Before we jump in, one more thing. If you are listening to this the week that it is airing, the week of April 23rd, next week, April 29th through May 3rd, is my 5-day Action Over Perfection Challenge. I'm so excited for this challenge. Days 1 through 4 are going to come via a private podcast audio recording and an email where you'll have an opportunity to listen to that week's little teaching and lesson, and then an action for you to take, really practicing getting into imperfect action with something that really matters to you. And then on day 5, we'll have a masterclass that will be all about your 90-day plan. I want to encourage you that even though it's May at the time we are finishing this challenge, it is still 100% possible for 2024 to be your best year yet. So if there is a thing that you've been wanting to do, that you've been wanting to take more action on more consistently, this 5-day challenge culminating in this masterclass is your ticket. And it is free to sign up. You can do it at honoryourspark.com/springchallenge. There will be prizes, there will be party vibes. It is going to be really, really fun. So sign up for the challenge. And if you're listening to this from the future, I may come up with a way of making some of this kind of evergreen. We will see, but there will be other challenges. So thanks so much for tuning in, and let's jump into the conversation with Dr. Sarah Kubrick. Sarah, thank you so much for joining me from the future over there in Australia, where you are currently in my tomorrow. I'm so excited for this conversation.
Thank you for having me. I'm honored to be here. This is a perfect way to start my Friday morning, a good chat to get the day started.
Yes. So what does it mean to you to honor your spark?
I think for me, that means being bold enough to do what my gut tells me to do. I think there is something like the audacity to listen to myself and to my instincts. And if you want, do you want a specific spark? Is that what you're wondering?
Oh, I mean, it could be. It could just be your general life spark, or something specific.
I think my spark, my longest love affair, my deepest spark is definitely with my work, which is a beautiful thing. And then sometimes also not the healthiest in terms of that being your hobby and your passion and your work. But I would say honoring that just meant really knowing my why and staying true to my values and to what resonates deep within when it comes to my work. And a lot of my decisions that I've made, obviously, you know, you'll consult with people who are in the space with you, but a lot of it was just made with my gut. And so that was following my spark.
Ooh, I love that. And we'll kind of circle back around to some of that later, because there's some things you get to in your book that I think we can dig deeper there. But I'm going to start just heavy hitter right out the gate. One phenomenon that I find really challenging as a therapist at this time in the world is that I think, like with a lot of things,
an attempt to correct something that did need correcting has resulted in sort of the pendulum swing to the opposite extreme, which in some cases is still kinder, but potentially damaging in entirely new ways. And I think one of the things that comes to mind for that is the discourse around trauma, and that we do not want to return to minimizing it, but there, some of the language feels very disempowering or blaming. And I worry sometimes we're trying to bubble wrap ourselves too much. I think you just do such a beautiful job navigating this with your approach and your language, even like the title of the book, It's On Me, Accept Hard Truths, Discover Yourself, Change Your Life. So I just want to open the floor around your perspective of this sort of modern dilemma that we face.
Yeah, I think in an effort to destigmatize and educate the larger public about psychological struggles, we've made it mainstream. And when anything is made mainstream, it loses its definition, it loses its depth, it loses its complexity. Yeah. And so for me, when I hear about trauma, the discourse that makes me disappointed or hesitant is, A, we're labeling everything as trauma. We're labeling discomfort as trauma. And that's just not true. Also, hard things don't have to be traumatic. And I think we also have to understand that someone could live through a quote unquote traumatic event and still not be traumatized.
Absolutely.
So I think there's just, we are slapping this label on everything that is remotely uncomfortable or that has impacted us in any sort of negative quote unquote way, which I think is incredibly unfair for those who actually struggle with trauma. And so the second part that makes me uncomfortable or really weary of the way we're using trauma is that it's become a label that means you are no longer responsible for the way you show up in the world. And that's a hard thing to say. Like, I want to tread carefully. I know this is not a popular opinion. And I think if you're experiencing something like PTSD, your freedom is limited in how you show up in the world. However, for a majority of people who have lived through traumatic events and are not traumatized, or individuals who don't actually have trauma, it's just become a convenient way to say, well, it's not my fault. Look at all the bad things that have happened to me. So you can't blame me for the decisions I'm making right now. And I think what's lost in this conversation is, like, no one wants to blame you. It's actually about empowering you and letting you know that you have what it takes to live a life that you want today. You do not need to be a victim to your past. And sometimes when we get overly comfortable with certain labels, we just kind of sit with it and we go, well, this is what my existence is reduced to. And there's comfort in that, and there's discomfort in that. And so that's where I'll end my talk. Sorry, that was so long, because I'm so passionate about this. You know, it's what we get for psych becoming mainstream.
Absolutely. And I'm just like over here clapping because all of that is so well said. And it is a really challenging thing to talk about because, like you said, it is very real that when people have been through certain things that of course it affects you, it leaves a mark. And it's not to say that that doesn't happen, but A, it doesn't happen nearly the amount that I think people think that it does, given the current discourse. Mm-hmm. And B, okay, if and when that is happening, now what? And that's what I think, you know, your book does such a good job at sort of having people step into their own power. And that's a big part of what I think is missing, because it's like the pick yourself up by your bootstraps generation, like, didn't exactly have it right either, right? But the self-empowerment is such an important and necessary part that I think is missing from a lot of conversations right now.
So many, but, you know, it's not just the trauma conversation, it's the inner child conversation. You know, it's, I don't know what other, you know, hot buzzwords you've heard, but so many of them start off being so helpful in terms of like, hey, that is really helpful to have vocabulary around what you're experiencing, or maybe what your patterns are, or what your block is. And yet when we go, well, it's my inner child running the show, you have to tell the individual they're no longer a child. Like, it's, I understand your inner child, but what we mean is, like, your wounds, your patterns, your impulses are taking over. But making it sound like there is a child running a show doesn't even make sense logically. If you're in a store with a child, or if you're doing something with a child, you're still an autonomous adult with a child. And that's what I want people to feel like. You're an autonomous adult. And yes, there's an inner child stirring up things, but be the adult in that relationship. And so for me, all these phrases that I think are so wonderful have been taken as kind of identities now, and as a way to sidestep responsibility.
Amen. Yeah. And in a way, it's almost made me lose my taste for parts work, which is sad because I do think that it can be powerful.
I love parts work. I know, but same.
And I was reading, actually, I don't know if you've read any of Alison Strasser's work, but she,
a little bit.
Yeah, I really like kind of her approach, because I told you, you inspired me to start digging deeper into existential therapy. So I went, that was the first book that I got. And she talks about the sort of the fluid sense of self is kind of the existential approach, right? And I'm like, oh, this is other language that we can use to describe all these things that can feel like discrepancies in how I'm showing up. Like, sure, I'm not to say that we can't, that that's, you know, incongruent with parts work. We can have both. But I almost like, I'm like leaning more toward that language because of how much I see parts work sort of turning into this eschewing responsibility.
Yeah, for sure. And I don't know if I use the word fluid in my book, but that's exactly the point I'm trying to make, is like your sense of self is constantly evolving. That's what I think I say, which means it will never be the same. It is fluid. And there is complexities. Now, obviously, there's going to be cognitive dissonance. There are going to be incongruencies and dissonances that we need to address. And yet, I think that when we look at ourselves as static parts, this is where we become restrained, and this is where it becomes less helpful. Even if you want to do parts work, I think about each part evolving. So it's like the way I do it is I integrate fluidity within maybe a static structure.
Ooh, I love that. So we're talking about self, and one of the biggest themes in the book is self-loss. And I just think there's so many interesting pieces to explore there, because the old language of sort of finding yourself, it's like, how do I know when I found her? Like, who am I supposed 100%. To be? So, I mean,
totally.
In a minute, I want to read kind of one of your definitions of self-loss, but just in general, with that sense of like, okay, if the self is fluid, like, how am I supposed to find her?
100%. Saying that you found yourself means that yourself exists and is completely formed outside of your participation. That to me is mind-blowing. So that's okay, but then you need to understand that you believe that you belong to a very particular belief structure. And I'm not saying that's a wrong structure. I just think a lot of people use a language without really understanding what the belief structure behind it is. So, you know, I describe essentialism versus existentialism in the book. So if you believe that you find yourself, that it's given to you, you fall into the camp of essentialism, or perhaps a lot of monotheistic religions. And again, nothing wrong with that. Also, there's a lot of Christian existentialists, so it's not that black and white. But I just think sometimes we say things and we don't even understand where they come from or why we believe that. And I love the create yourself, because to me, essentialism is a little like determinism, which means you're meant to be this person. You were created to be this particular version. And although there's so much comfort and the responsibility that it takes away from you, I do find it meaningless. It's like I'm acting out someone else's story. The story was written for me. I'm here. I'm in a play. I'm acting it out. And then I die. Just follow the script. You know, you like it, you don't like it. You had no participation writing the script. You're just the actor, and then you're discarded. And to me, that's a horrifying thought. Like, I think freedom of will is really important. I think writing your own narrative is really important. And so to me, I lean into the existentialism, because it's saying you have all the freedom. You have all, and therefore you have all the responsibility. And to me, I actually find meaning in the creation itself. And it's why I gravitate towards that And and he makes me less anxious than being like, did I find her? Like, is this the right one? Did I fail? Did I pass? Like, there's this pass fail mentality with the other way of living. Well, this is like, you're gonna try, you're gonna fail, you're gonna get messy, you're gonna clean it up, you're gonna just kind of mold life, paint life, whatever, and then you're gonna be like, ta-da, this is what I came up with by the time I die. And to me, I love that.
Yes, that we are creating and kind of constantly iterating and tweaking like who we are and who we want to become.
Absolutely.
This episode is brought to you by a private podcast from yours truly called You Are Motherfucking Enough. It's a four-part series that will teach you how to shift from patterns of self-doubt and criticism to owning your enoughness. I created You Are Motherfucking Enough because I'm tired of seeing how often self-doubt, shame, and constant criticism hold people back from stepping fully into their purpose, passion, and aliveness. And I believe that it takes a lot more than just an empathetic listener, whether that's a therapist, coach, or friend, to actually learn and apply the strategies that will allow you to make that positive shift long-term. I'm not kidding, y'all. The value of these episodes is worth the cost of multiple therapy or coaching sessions, and you can get instant access to this series for $0. I've condensed 12 years of experience working with these issues into 60 minutes of content. You don't want to miss this one. Get instant free access to listen almost anywhere you get your podcasts by signing up at honoryoursparkcom/enough. That link will also be in the show notes for the episode that you're currently listening to. All right, let's get back to the show.
Cool. Like okay, so self-loss. I'm just going to read this little couple of sentences here.
Okay.
So self-loss, you write, is being estranged from and lacking congruence, resonance, and alliance with who we truly are. It's the feeling of being inconsistent and inauthentic, of having our actions, feelings, and decisions cease to represent how we understand and experience ourselves as truly being. So I love the focus on that, and because I just imagine that there's so many people out there, whether or not they view that they are creating themselves or have even, you know, that is a thing that's in their worldview. So many people are experiencing self-loss. So I wonder, this might be a big question, but just like, how would someone know if they were experiencing self-loss?
It's a great question. So I think feelings and behaviors will tell you. Feeling disoriented, feeling broken, feeling empty, feeling incredibly lonely, even if you are around people, feeling confused. These are often the feelings that accompany being lost. Think about being lost in the woods. You'd probably feel a lot of the same things. And for me, it's the behaviors that really kind of bring it to life in terms of, I don't know if you've ever done something and then gone home and been like, what did I just do? Like, who was that? Like, what possessed me? Or like sending a text or like showing up in a way and you're like, why would I do that? Like, it's almost like a stranger, and people will describe it like, oh my God, it's like someone took over, like someone possessed me. And then I just did. And they'll say things like that, where it's like, that to me is a slow indication that you are losing your grasp on truly who you are. And if you don't stop that type of behavior and fragmentation, you will eventually not even be able to recognize that the way this person acted didn't resonate. The other thing that is really common is that individuals will have a really hard time making decisions. Because what are you making a decision based on? They're like, well, just choose. Like, obviously, you know, anxiety can make it difficult for you to make decisions. Sure. But sometimes people genuinely don't know their preferences. They don't know their values. So then how do they make a decision about where they live, where they go to school, who they date? How do you know who you date if you don't even know who you are? How would you even know who's compatible for you? So decision making can be a really huge indication that you're feeling lost or you are lost. And then, you know, the last one will be over-identifying with roles. So you're a wife, you're a mother, you're a girlfriend, whatever it is, that becomes your entire life. And there's a lot of reasons why we do that. But sometimes either it's because we're lost and we're trying to gain an identity through an external means, or we actually get lost in that role because we get so excited and then we don't have boundaries. And then, but at the end of the day, if you realize that one role that you play has become your entire identity, chances are that you might be a little lost or on your way of getting lost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you just said something there that I think it hits with all of it. And that's like from external means, right? Whether that's shaping your identity from external means, making your choice of what to have for lunch or where to go to school from external cues, and not really having any sense of like, I think of, you know, we had the external antenna and the internal, and some folks, especially if they grew up and had to be very responsible for other people's feelings and stabilizing the environment around them, it's like we get very good at reading the external cues, right? But the internal can be just like, I turn in and I can't, nothing is there. It's just static, right? And that as a means of self-loss. So it's a big task if someone finds themselves in that spot where they recognize like, holy shit, I think I'm all out there and I don't even know what's in here. So I think if someone finds themselves there, read the book, go to therapy, like do all the things, but like, what's a starting place for people who find themselves in that position?
For sure. That's a great question. And I want to validate how scary that place is. I think that these big existential questions haven't been honored in the sense of no one empathizes with how hard it is. If it's not in the DSM, do you know what I mean? It's like,
yes,
okay, cool. Like what? Okay. Like get over it. It's life, you know? And I sometimes think these existential struggles are just as painful. They're not pathological, but not everything painful is pathological. And so I think it is a part of life. And I just want to honor that state because for me, that was the most painful time in my life. And as a consequence, I ended up developing a panic disorder that lasted for a couple of years. And so if you're in that spot, I would say start slow with observation. So I don't think there's a self without self-expression. I write about this. You can't just think about who you are and that's who you are. You only become you through your actions. This is key. So what I would suggest is observe who you are right now. You might not like this person. That's okay. There's no need to judge this. But what you need to do is go, okay, what are my actions teaching me about who I am? And get really familiar, get really enthusiastic about just, you know, when you're on a first date, and you observe everything from their tone to their body language to did they graze my thigh on purpose or by accident? What does it mean that they wanted a second drink but not the third drink? What does it like? That's the kind of obsession I want you to have when you're observing yourself. And once you figure out who you are, then you get to, in this very moment, you get to kind of explore what things align with who you want to be and what things don't. And then you get to decide with every single little decision you make throughout the day, which sounds really tedious, I'm sorry, because it is, who you want to become. Because every decision you make, from what you wear to what you eat to how much you exercise to who you hang out with to what job you're choosing to the boundaries on your phone, all of it will contribute to the person you become from moment to moment. And then that's when the creation kicks in. So first observe, then decide, then start dabbling, trying, and experimenting.
I love it. And that it's so true that by practicing in those very simple day-to-day, moment-to-moment experiences, that's what helps build the muscle. Like you started off at the very beginning of like, it's trusting my gut. It's like moving in alignment with what I just know and feel inside. Mm. And whenever I have folks who are just like, I don't know, like everyone always gets annoyed with me because I can't ever, you know, pick a restaurant or pick what I want to eat. And like, and that's just, you know, emblematic of their whole life, right?
Of course.
And so sometimes we might actually have real things in the room. But one of the sort of visualizations that I go to is like, all right, we got two bowls of ice cream sitting right here, strawberry and chocolate. Let's turn toward the strawberry. Notice what happens. We turn toward the chocolate. Notice what, right? And just like, how do you know? Because it's like, oh, well, I want the chocolate. how did you know that, right? Like, that's where the gold is. What told you that you wanted that?
No, absolutely. I think something I'll get my clients to do, it's similar, but it's like, I'd be like, walk me through it. Cause I'd be like, I don't know what, okay, for you, I like it because they're making automatic decisions and you're trying to slow them down and get them to process their decisions. I'll have clients who like, I have no idea what I like ever about anything. Cool. Okay. So then I'll go, walk me through your day in the most excruciating detail possible from when you woke up to this moment. We will literally go from like, I woke up and my alarm went off. I'll be like, great. Did you like your alarm? I'm like, what? Ooh. Like, did you like the sound of your alarm? First time they were thinking about it. No. Okay, cool. Then I got up, put on my slippers. I'd be like, great. Do you like them? Every single thing they told me that they did, I asked, did you like it? Not because I think the answer is relevant, but because I want you to start getting used to discerning what your preferences are.
Yes.
Did you like your chair? They're like, Sarah, are you seriously talking to me about my chair and my door? I'm like, yes, I am. Because I have pretty strong feelings about most things in my environment, and I never used to, but that's because I understand how much my environment impacts me. And so I think understanding that we exist in a world and that world really impacts us makes everything quite important. And so if you don't know what your preferences are, start observing everything in your house, in your room, in your life, and go, do I like it? And see what the ratio is. Did you naturally gravitate and build your life in a way that you liked it, but you just didn't process that you liked it because it didn't feel like an assessment? And then you can start to trust your gut a little more. Or did you build a life that was had nothing to do with your preferences and you're existing in it and you're miserable? And so I think that's also like, I love the ice cream method. And this is just kind of another version of that.
Oh, I love that too. And it's like, yeah, like you said, the answer is not all that important. It's just recognizing, like, how do we start to pay attention to the cues that I do or don't like something? And then we're all going to have to live with some aspects of things in our day-to-day life or environment that we don't like, but good to know. Because like you said, if your whole life ends up being constructed around things you don't like you're probably going to feel pretty miserable, and maybe we should do something about that.
Or pretty anxious or pretty depressed. Sometimes it's just not living your own life. That was me with anxiety. I wasn't living my own life, so I was anxious. That was it. That was literally the only trigger. And it took years, but once I started to feel like I owned and embodied my life, my anxiety stopped. How wild. We never talk about anxiety that way. And we also never talk about it as something that can be temporary, oftentimes. And we don't talk about it as something that we've inflicted on ourselves because we're inauthentic. And that was very, very true for me. And so there is a way out, and your body will tell you when you are not living what you're supposed to be living.
Yes, right. It's like where, like you said, where in the DSM are we looking at potential existential causes of suffering? We're not. We're just like, oh, she meets the criteria for anxiety disorder or panic disorder, and so we'll treat it with CBT or whatever, which might help give you some tools, but it was not going to fix the real issues there, which was changing your circumstances.
And this is exactly when I completely switched to existentialism, actually, because when I started grad school, we were doing all these, like, you know, you look at all the theories, and I was flirting with existentialism, but I was also like very Freudian, very like neuroscience-y, very whatever. And then when I encountered my own stuff and realized, like, oh, actually it did not work for me. And actually all the things that were causing my own suffering, the therapeutic modalities weren't targeting the cause. And so I think I kind of got to experiment of like, okay, I had a bit of somatic, I had a bit of attachment. There's things I really liked from each modality, don't get me wrong, but I think that was a really big wake-up call and one of the reasons why I fully shifted, because I was like, I think this is a cause for a lot of people's sufferings and it's never addressed. And I don't think I would have fully healed if I didn't have existentialism in my life. And that's a wild thing to say. And I know it's not going to apply to everyone, but I think there's enough people like me where my work is going to be relevant.
Absolutely. And I think for folks who don't know your story, when you said earlier that like that's the deepest pain you've ever felt, they should also know you've literally lived through wars as a child. Like
yes.
You've experienced things that would, you know, classify depending on how you process them as big T trauma, right? But like
they
this
sure
pain
would
was deeper.
Yeah, it was deeper. And, you know, I think it was compounding pain for sure. Mm. I think what made it deeper and something I hopefully articulated well in the book was that in my adulthood, I participated in my suffering. In my childhood, I was purely the victim.
Yeah.
And there is a difference in level of pain in that because I didn't blame myself for what has happened as a child. I didn't distrust myself. I distrusted humanity, another issue. You know, I had my trauma responses to that, but I was still a somewhat safe space in terms of like, okay, like, you know, you're a child. And then in my adulthood, when I was 20, I realized, oh my God, 90% of what's happening is my fault. Now, I could look back and go, well, it's because of my traumatic childhood and, you know, I wasn't super self-aware because I was in fight or flight and I was detached and out. But that wasn't a good enough reason for me. I still went, wow, this is my fault. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've now lived outside of a war conflict for 14 years. How can that possibly... How can I possibly put all the responsibility on that? And I'm kind of surprised I thought that way as a 20-year-old. I'm pretty impressed now looking back. I'm like, good for you, Sarah. But I think that's where the real pain came from was A, not dealing with my child and not holding my inner child, if you want to say, and not trying to take care of her. And then also making so many decisions, every decision truly that was inauthentic. The only authentic decision I made during that time was becoming a psych. Truly, that is the only authentic thing I did at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what you said about like, sure, if we zoom out, we could say that it's all connected, you know, the experiences mm-hmm. that you had in childhood. And I love what you said around just like, well, at this point, it's been 14 years. Like, I should probably do something about this.
I should probably do something about it. And what was more difficult was that when I was in my therapist's office, she had to tell me that what I lived through was traumatic. Because I didn't know. And that's kind of embarrassing because I was in grad school to be a psych. But I think when something is so normalized, especially within my family of like everyone went through it. So it's like, remember that time we were in a bomb shelter? Like there was, that was just a normal way to start the conversation. So I think, you know, when you're unaware of what hurt you, you don't know how to heal it. And I also just needed someone to point out that some of the things I went through, they did impact me and how they impacted me, because I think I was in self-preservation and I believed that by pretending it wasn't there, I was somehow stronger and it wouldn't get me. And I think a lot of people can relate to that experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not true though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One other thing I want to share from the book, and I think it's like just all this nuance around like, okay, developing that self-knowledge, self-trust, you know, being able to see like what aligns, what doesn't align. And then also recognizing that sometimes we, whether it's because we're hungry or because our mm-hmm. brain is like creating some narrative because we all, you know, have negativity bias and all of that.
Totally.
But like we've still got to do some filtering. So you write in the book, our narratives are powerful and our narratives are not always a reflection of reality. This is why it's important to have the skill of observation as well as the ability to separate facts from projections, assumptions, and interpretations. This will help not just our relationships with others, but also with ourselves. And I just love that because, again, it's like so challenging that we're being like, okay, like, you know, listen to yourself and also like maybe sometimes be a little bit skeptical.
100%. I actually think he has to be both. You need to observe and assess at all times. I also, this is another issue with pop psychology. Listen to your inner self. My God, please don't. Like sometimes, like do not listen to yourself. I think this is the worst.
Your anxiety is lying to you.
Yeah. This is like sometimes the worst advice we're giving people. It's like, No, you shouldn't listen to your anxiety. No, you shouldn't listen to your super negative narrative. No, you shouldn't listen to your impulse to text your ex-boyfriend. No, just no. So I think we need to listen in terms of we need to observe it. We need to acknowledge it. We need to validate it. Like, yes, this is what I'm feeling. And then we go, where is it coming from? What is it serving? And is it helping me become the person I want to be? You need to also be cognitive about it. This is where the holistic component comes in. It's not just your feelings that are going to lead you home. And obviously, it's not just your brain that's going to lead you home. They actually genuinely need to balance each other out. They're a team.
And that's where the empowering side of like if for people who want to use parts language comes in, because it's like the wise adult is in there. Right. And the wise adult probably already knows that you shouldn't be texting that ex right now, right? But it's like,
Probably does know.
how do we like call her in? How do we get her in the driver's seat now?
Yeah, and how do we know that when she says don't do it, she does it from love? She's not trying to punish you. She's not trying to control you. She's not
Saying
taking
you're an
away your
idiot for wanting to
pleasure.
do it.
Yeah, for sure. And she's not like, suffer. Like, I don't want you to have a healthy sexual life. Just be here alone. Like, she's not trying to do these things to you. What she's trying to do is protect you. And I think we need to understand that our discernment, our assessment, our judgments, when you're in a healthy headspace, are really there to protect you and lead you and guide you, and that they respect you and they want what's best for you. And I think we have such issues with the inner critic, which another word, which totally get it, but we need to discern between the inner critic and just inner evaluation, because inner evaluation is incredibly important.
I love that. Okay, I wore this shirt special for today,
Oh
and it says "Embrace the existential dread." So I would
my
love
God, I
to
need this t-shirt.
I would love to ask you, what does it mean to you to embrace the existential dread?
Yeah, to me, it means I see existential dread, or glimpses of an existential crisis, which I have all the time. I just want to be really transparent. I see it as universe, or as myself checking in with me. All these hard questions, all these anxieties, it's just going, Sarah, are you good? Are you doing what you want to be doing? Are you aligned with your values? Are you going in a direction you want to be going in? I don't see it as threatening anymore, and I used to for a really long time. I genuinely see it as a check-in. And when you see existential dread as a check-in, completely reframes that relationship with the suffering and with the questions and with the lack of answers. And so I find it liberating, but not just that, I find it that it almost gives me confidence that when I move forward from this dread, I will be doing it in a more authentic way.
I love that. I love that. And it's just like the recognition that it is completely normal and that we can
Oh
sort
my
of
God, yeah.
ride those waves, right?
Yeah, and it is about riding the waves, like not trying to, here we do body surfing. Surfing in Australia is a lot of that, but it's like big waves come and you're not trying to like hold your ground because you will get destroyed by the wave. Like, that's if you're walking, like you're either jumping headfirst into or under the wave, or you're trying to jump and ride the wave on top, but you are not trying to hold your ground necessarily. And that's kind of how I find that process. So there is no holding your ground. It will sweep you. That is just a fact. So now you get to choose how you want to ride it. And I always try to be on top. It scares me. I don't love being under because the pull is harder, but some people like it. So for me, it's like, yeah, go with it. Otherwise, it will feel like it's destroying you, or it's threatening you, or it's breaking you, rather than just guiding and allowing you to flow in a certain direction.
Beautiful. Well, I could keep talking to you forever, but we'll
Same.
wrap up the conversation and just let people know what you're up to, where they can find you, and then of course all of your links will be in the show notes too.
Amazing. So I'm most active on Instagram. That's millennial.therapist. My book, It's On Me, is sold anywhere books are sold. I think it's also being distributed and translated in about 17 languages at this point. And I also do write longer style essays, articles, almost on a weekly basis that are a little more existential than my Instagram content. And it's on Substack. It's called Notes from My Phone. So you can find me there as well.
Amazing. This has been so heart-filling. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for wearing that t-shirt and asking the best questions.
Yes, friend, you made it to the end of the episode. I so appreciate you tuning in. And if you enjoyed this episode, make my day by subscribing and leaving a 5-star rating to help other people find this podcast. I'd love for you to connect with me on Instagram at HonorYourSpark. And don't forget to sign up for my 4-episode private podcast series all about kicking self-criticism to the curb at honoryourspark.com/enough. See you in the next episode.